Hello, everyone. Welcome to an episode of Coffee Chats with Researchers. I am Katie Butner. It is a Wednesday evening for me. I am recording this from my office. I have no clue what day it will be for you, but whatever it is, I hope it's been a good one. I am excited for you to listen to this conversation with Dr. Melissa Morabito, who is a criminologist today, but has an enjoyable story about her journey to being in this position now and kind of the steps she's taken and the sort of different hats she's worn along the way. And specifically, I'm excited because she talks about some of the things that she's been focused on in her current research around police response to vulnerable populations and how we've seen so much work in the last few years around those responses from police organizations and police officers specifically. So a lot of work, a lot of training, a lot of attention in that space. But yeah, what we're seeing is outcomes that remain the same. So she talks a bit about what might be going on there, or just like the fact that there's more understanding that needs to happen because folks are taking initiative and making the effort, and we're seeing police officers learn better approaches or more effective approaches to populations at risk. But what we're seeing is the outcomes end up being the same. It's really a great conversation. I'm excited about it. So sit back, grab your coffee, and enjoy this conversation.
Usually what I want to start with is to say thank you so much for being a part of the conversation, but definitely to ask you who you are and if you could give like a brief overview of what you do in your body of work, that would be great.
Well, thank you so much for having me today. It's always fun to talk about my work, so I appreciate that. My name is Melissa Morabito, and I am a criminologist. I'm an associate professor at the University of Massachusetts Lowell. I come at this from sort of a different background than a lot of people. I have an MSW when I started off as a social worker, and I went back to school and then got a PhD in justice law and society at American University. So I'm sort of one of those cross-sectional, you know, interdisciplinary people, which definitely frames a lot of the work that I do. So I am also a policing researcher, which is also makes me a little bit different from a lot of the people I'm sure that you've been talking to. Most of my research started off with policing, and I do a lot of work on police response to vulnerable populations. So some of that is, a lot of that right now is behavioral health. So looking at people with mental illnesses, looking at people with substance use disorders, and what the police response looks like. And I think that sort of opened me up to looking at the violence prevention and doing work in that area. I think there's been so much effort, especially around sexual assault, on reforming police practices, and the outcomes are still the same. So part of my interest is what's happening, right? Why are we not seeing differences for victims based on all these changes that police are making to their practices and what's going on here? And that's what led me into the research. I worked on a project looking at the attrition of sexual assault cases with April Padavina and Linda Williams, and we looked at six jurisdictions across the United States. It was an amazing collaboration. Linda is very victim-centered. April is very much a numbers person and has a strong sense of the entire criminal justice system. And I was the policing person from at the beginning. So, you know, we had to identify the police departments. We had to figure out where we were going to start and then follow cases from the time they reported to the police all the way through the entire criminal justice system, right, to see where the cases fall out. And so that's always, you know, I feel like a lot of the emphasis gets put on the police as gatekeepers, like what could they be doing differently, what they're doing wrong. So it was a very interesting project for me to sort of, you know, think about how do the police fit into this whole larger picture. And I think I've totally strayed off topic. So
No, okay. You're great.
This is why I use PowerPoint in class, because I tend to go way off tangent and PowerPoint brings me back.
And this is one of my favorite projects that we're doing and that I get to work on, for the reason that they're like, in this, with this at least part, no one's asking us to ask specific questions. We want to make it useful for the field, but it means that I do get to just have a conversation. And when you say something cool, I can just ask a question about it. So okay. We could hit all the questions there, we could hit none of them, and like it would still be fine. So,
okay.
No, I think that that was an excellent overview of kind of your pathway as well. One of the things that I think people will be interested to hear a little bit about, and I know I am, is definitely the connection between like doing having an MSW and then going into a criminology background. So can you speak a bit to kind of what you maybe saw in your work as a social worker that led you to want to do that as a next step, and how those that connection may have been strengthened a bit by that journey?
Sure. So it was kind of a strange journey. In between my first and second year of social work school, I got a job running a play site for the Police Athletic League. So it was located in a housing project. And, you know, I ran activities and things for the children all day long. And so it was fascinating to me that because the police were obviously involved and the youth officers would come to the site usually about like 3 to 4 times a week. And the youth officers really were trying, like they made balloon animals. And, you know, it was just, you could see they just, there was some like, they just didn't know how to engage to some extent, but they were trying really, they were really making the effort. And I was sort of fascinated by this. I'd never really thought much about the police at all prior to that. And I also noticed that the little kids would come run to the car, right? They wanted to see the lights on. They wanted to see the police officers. They wanted to see the handcuffs. Like they thought it was really cool. And around a certain age, police would show up and the kids would move in another direction. And I had always welcomed, you know, teenagers and things of the site. I was, you know, maybe not supposed to, but I figured if they were there, then they weren't doing anything else. And, you know, they had to look after their younger siblings and that sort of thing. So it got me really thinking, you know, why there is this disparity and what's the age, right? Where there's the cutoff where the police are no longer your friend and now they're your enemy. And so that got me kind of thinking. And I also around the same time had a professor who recommended applying for the Presidential Management Fellowship. So I did that. I applied for that and I got a job with the federal government. So the way that works is you work for 2 years and you get a position with a federal agency. And I was hired by the COPS office, the Community Oriented Policing Services. And around that time, they were doing a lot of work with engaging community. They were interested in things like preventing elder abuse and crime in schools. And I thought, well, this is an interesting fit. And so I took that position, which was a really steep learning curve. I mean, from things like I used to sit in meetings with a notebook and just write down things that I didn't know what people were talking about. And I had a good friend who had worked there for a while and we would go walk after work or go get a drink. And we would go through my list of things that I didn't know. I mean, things like SRO, right? So in a policing context, SRO is a school resource officer, but I swear I sat through a whole meeting. I'm like, why are they talking about single room occupancy? I had done housing advocacy. I'm like, what is happening here? And so it took a while to be able to understand the language. And, it was also insightful for me because you have people who are talking about the same thing and think they're talking about completely different things sitting at the table, right? Which is sort of, right? Helps us think a lot about what's going on. So it was definitely a hard learning curve to understand how that all worked. After a while, I realized that I was not a policy person right away, that there was so much that I wanted to know. And that influenced me to go back to school. I did a rotation at the Police Executive Research Forum, which has also been a connection that I've kept over the years. And they are a membership organization of college-educated police chiefs in the United States. And so that also kind of showed me there was this path of like, there's so much we don't know and there's this opportunity for research. And from there, I applied to get my PhD. And that got me going down that path. But yes, it's definitely, I think I see both sides. Like when I leave meetings, I kind of feel like, you know, both sides are angry at me that the mental health, the public health people are kind of like, she's pro police, and the policing people are like, oh, she hates the police and she's, you know, thinking too much like the victims. And I figure that means I'm probably in a good space. But it's been an interesting ride so far. I like to tell my students, like, I could tell them where it's like a totally linear path and I just went from one thing to the next. But really I did with what was interesting at the time. And, you know, here I am.
Thank you. I think that that's not only like it's illuminating to see just that there are options to sit a little bit in the middle, right? Kind of what you're talking about kind of blending a bit of the silos. And I think it's really interesting to hear you talk about leaving a meeting with everybody being a little bit upset about you and like, or of what you said, and that maybe is this the right place to be in as like a professional. But I also think, or I wonder from your perspective, what is kind of a next step of that? Because I think having the path that you just laid out, where you kind of, because of circumstance, found yourself in a blended space, which I think is an interesting and sometimes common experience. I've said this to many people when they're talking about getting their MSW. I'm like, honestly, the most valuable part of it is your internship experiences. The coursework can be really great, but being exposed to workplaces is really what decided, like, I wouldn't have gone into research if it hadn't been for that opportunity. So just to say that like, having this kind of come into your life, piquing an interest and recognizing that it's really important to you and something you were interested in, now being fully in that world, I guess, and that has been your career. And when you say, looking at how maybe people are a bit still, I don't want to say divided, but in have different camps of understanding, what do you see as that next step with continuing to build those bridges and those connections? Because at least from what it sounds like and what I'd assume a little bit, that building those connections is really the next step to change.
Well, I agree and disagree actually with that statement that building the bridges is the next step to change. I think that there's room for all the camps. I think that you need the advocates who are agitating for change. I think that they push the conversation forward. I've always been a person who's worked in the system, and I know that there are lots of folks who don't agree with that approach. But for me, if a police department comes to me and says, we want to try this new program, we want to evaluate it and see if it works, I will go in and assume the best of intentions, right? Because that to me is pretty brave, right? That they're putting themselves out there, that they would want to test the program and that they're even trying something different. And so I will go in with the best of intentions and not with a gotcha approach. And I don't see the benefit of that. And I think there's a lot of benefit to finding out that things don't work. I think
Absolutely,
the idea.
Yeah.
And I think the idea to go into those sorts of things comes from like the agitation on the outside. So I think there's room for both. And I sort of approach my research like in different ways. So if I'm an evaluation partner, if I'm an academic partner, I will go in and assume good intentions, right? And we'll collect the data in partnership and we'll you know, review the results, and I will allow the agency to help me frame what we find because they understand it. The sexual assault project I worked on, we knew we were going to find bad things because there's nobody doing that well. And so, you know, we decided early on that we were going to keep the police departments confidential, right? Keep the communities confidential, because there was nothing to be gained from saying, aha, you're doing a terrible job, because every police department, every community is not doing what they should be doing in that area. And so that was the decision, was that, you know, rather than put these agencies on the defensive, which again, there would be no benefit to that in terms of encouraging people to change. And so we made that choice. And then other times, you know, like I've been approached by police departments, we're under consent decree and we need to review some of our data. We need to make partners with academics. Would you be willing to look at this? All right. And so, you know, in that case, say it's up to you. Do you want to put your name out there? What do you want to do? And so I kind of leave it that way. And so I think there's room for everybody. I think we absolutely need people who are like agitating for like the most extreme solution, right? Because I think that gets us closer to a solution that's probably everybody's unhappy with, but is much better for all of us.
Yeah, absolutely. And I appreciate you sharing that thought. And I think it's really well put that coming in with best intentions and wanting to offer opportunities for people to see through in kind of that learning objective that they set out. Because I would absolutely agree that there's so much room for change, but there's also a step of trying to not isolate us away from wanting to engage in meaningful, important work. And like you're saying, being open to knowing that like, we're going to find not great things, but we got to find the not great things in order for us to have a different and maybe more effective conversation.
I also think there's a lot of work to be done just about logistics, and it's not very glamorous work. I kind of call it the infrastructure work of going in and saying, and not just for police departments, but for, you know, social service providers as well. We're trying this new thing. Does it work? What kind of data do we need to collect beforehand? What kind of data do we want to collect at the midpoint? How do we know that what we're doing is doing what we think it's supposed to? And I think, you know, for agencies, they can do that, you know, short term. They're going to collect information for their own, you know, business activities. Yeah. But I think as researchers, it's sort of like at that point, should we even be doing this at all? Right. There's the like, how is it effective in the short term, but also like, what does this mean long term for people? And particularly, you know, working with vulnerable populations, what does this mean at the end of the day? Like, are we making things worse for folks, even if we're achieving the short term goal of maybe getting them to report crime or, you know, like, what does that mean long term? And so that's sort of like, but these agencies are not built for or set up to do evaluation of their own programs. And, you know, that infrastructure is super important.
There's just, I'm teaching research methods. I've taught both the first and second sections of that for our MSW students. And it's always that like sort of rich conversation around like, why do I need to do this? Like,
I was just thinking that same thing. That's
what I'm telling you about.
And because I remember thinking the same thing in my MSW program, like, I just want to do the work. You know, like, let me out there do the work. Why do I need to waste my time with this?
Exactly.
I only knew, right?
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. It's always been fascinating on the other side to have worked and merged into like a research phase. And you're like, oh man, if I only had paid attention in this moment, you know. I apologize. I just got my coffee refilled. So
No, please drink. Don't apologize for that. I'm doing the same thing.
So I think what I'd love to hear about is like the current projects that you have going on. You've mentioned a little bit of some things that are past work that you have. But yeah, if you could talk a bit to what you're currently working on right now, that would be great.
So the sexual violence project that I worked on was, I'm trying to think, we were awarded that in 2012. I was pregnant with my son when we got the award, and he's now going to be 9 this weekend. So I'd like to say that
we're
10 years old.
Oh, yeah.
So it, you know, we're still really in the data and writing that up and trying to understand. We've had a few papers come out from there. The most recent one looking at the effects of investigating these cases on detectives. And that was something that I did most of the interviews of police officers. After social work school, I cannot interview victims. I just can't do it. I will interview police officers, prosecutors till the cows come home. But victims, like, I can't separate out to do that. So I did most of the detective interviews. And I noticed, like, it was very clear from those interviews how it was affecting them. And that was something that early on in the project, I knew. I'm like, I want to write this up when we're done.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Can you talk a bit about, I know again that was now 10 years old, but can you talk a bit about that project and sort of how that shaped kind of what you're doing, where you're looking toward now?
Sure. So, that project had a huge impact on me and my research agenda probably for the rest of my life. That's probably the biggest project I will ever work on. Mm-hmm. I've learned that I do not like projects with lots of sites. It's hard, you know, it's a full-time job to manage. So we looked at 6 sites, and so it was across the country, looking at from the time that the complaints came in all the way through the process to see where they fell out, like all the way to the trials, right? And there were so few trials. I mean, that was the thing. It was like, and that was one of the things that really stuck with me. There's lots of findings. There's a 100+ page report on NCJRS if you're interested in reading. But one of the big highlights for me was that, interviewing detectives and talking to them, there were cases that they felt really strongly about that should go forward. And prosecutors just said, no, like, there's not enough evidence here. And that connection between the police and the prosecutors, where police were like, we could make an arrest here, but what do you think? And, you know, that some of that was shocking to me, right? I mean, so the standard for arrest is probable cause. And the standard for prosecuting somebody is, you know, you need to convict them beyond a reasonable doubt. And those are not the same standard, right? Beyond a reasonable doubt is a much higher standard. And so if police are then looking to see, does a prosecutor think that they'll be able to successfully prosecute this case, they're taking that standard and bringing it down to the police level. But some of this is sort of a consequence of reform, right? That police couldn't be trusted to investigate these cases. So they needed to loop the prosecutors in early right? And so they did. And prosecutors are like, yeah, you know, I don't think this case is going to go anywhere. And police are like, well, why are we going to arrest somebody and go through all that paperwork and that time and, you know, have this on this person's record if you're not going to go anywhere with it? And so that was kind of a, you know, an interesting outcome for me. I mean, I'm trying to remember, I should have looked at the exact numbers before I talked to you, but, you know, like less than 3%, I think, ended up in a jury trial, which was what we heard from prosecutors. Juries don't like these cases. Like, well, how do you know if you haven't put them before juries? And so much of this was like, prosecution is like a black box. You know, I mean, the police departments were all like, yeah, come on in, come look at our case files. Like, it's totally fine. And they were used to it, right? I mean, that's sort of what they do. But the prosecutor's offices were much more cautious, right? They just were like, well, let me tell you, I can tell you what's happening. No, I'd really rather, you know, systematically look through your case files. And that was also interesting, right? It was much more, they were much more suspicious.
Yeah. And it sounds like it really gave a good look at to how navigating that really would be like for you moving forward again, like what it would really take to work with survivor cases and policing and prosecutors. Like you say, it's just such like a complex inner working.
Yes. We definitely understood a little bit better about how the system works and how complicated it is. I mean, that was one of the big findings. And also so much turnover. I mean, prosecutors would leave and police chiefs would leave. And then we'd have to go back in and explain the whole study again.
Right.
Please don't, you know, honor your predecessors, MOU here and continue working with us.
And it sort of sounds, it makes you realize just how much exactly what you're saying is kind of like person oriented, like who's the person kind of in that role? Are they on board? Is there buy-in? Because like you're saying, what I think people don't realize is, at least from my anecdotal perspective, we see the push to say report, 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 right? Make sure you hold someone accountable if you're okay with it. But what we don't know or see is those statistics where the percentage of those cases that I might encourage you to want to hold someone accountable through a criminal justice system, but the amount that actually get prosecuted is so low that it's not just that one stop where you call the police to make sure that this is being documented. But there's just, that's not where it ends, I guess is the point. And that messaging doesn't feel like it's always there.
Yes. So I was just reminded me of I interviewed police detectives, and I interviewed prosecutors. And we, you know, I did most of them, my colleagues did other parts of the project. And so there was one, we allowed them to pick the cases that they discussed with us because we wanted to, like something that was fresh or stuck with them. And so one of the sites, a detective and a prosecutor actually discussed the same case, which was just luck. It only happened once, but the detective described it as her most successful case. And it was interesting because it was one where the perpetrator was found not guilty. But it was a woman who had was a vulnerable person, had a substance use disorder, was a sex worker. And it was a particularly brutal assault. And I will not go into details. And so she reported it, which was also, you know, unusual, but it was particularly bad. And so did their start by believing, and they really, you know, investigated this case. And I think, you know, so at the end of the trial, the victim said to the detective, thank you so much. You know, thank you so much for believing me. Thank you so much for doing all this for me. You know, and like that moment, it made me think about like, well, what does justice mean? Right. I mean, so for this woman, even though like this guy was going to go free, it still felt like the justice system had been marshaled for her and that she was an important person in this world. But the prosecutor described this as their most challenging case. And it was like a big disappointment because it was, you know, there was so much evidence and it was so terrible and the perpetrator should have been found guilty. But here you have two people who are working together very closely and they had completely different perspectives on this one case, right? And also different from the victim, right? Who may have been outraged, but was not.
Yeah, it sounds really enlightening to be able to witness both pathways and both right, to just get that. It's a rare opportunity that any of us are really in multiple camps. We're all often seeing it so strongly from one perspective because it's what we work in. And so to be able to see and hear even from those folks the diverse perspective of the experience. I was like, what you're saying, like from one end, it feeling wildly supported, which is great. And then the other feeling like it was the hardest case that they'd ever gone through, right? So, which is good, right? But still, it sounds just like a worthwhile and valuable experience that being a researcher, I think, gives you, which I think is one of the cool things about doing research is that you often are working across these different things because you're trying to collect different stories, different voices, different perspectives. And I think it does give you a little bit more context to understanding how people are, what people are bringing in. And yeah.
Well, sure. I mean, I think it's easy to look at the problem as police officers, police departments are doing enough or prosecutors aren't prosecuting enough. And like, we don't think about the intersection of the two where prosecutors are like,
Yeah.
I mean, seeing in case files where the prosecutor's like, no, I'm not going to go forward with this. And then the detective doesn't interview witnesses because
right.
prosecutors made that decision. Right. So we could say that the police didn't fully investigate the case and we could leave it there, but that doesn't really tell the whole story then.
It's right.
The prosecutors on the prosecutor's word. And is it worth the time for the detective to put into that case when they could be investigating a different case where the prosecutor might go forward? And I don't have the answer to that. Right. I mean, it's, they're all terrible choices.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So thinking forward, what comes next for you?
Sure. So, so I have been doing a lot of work on thinking about, again, the police response to behavioral health and ways to sort of reduce the police footprint, right? I think, and it connects to me to the sexual violence when I think about the numbers of people who don't report, right? We know that less than half of all assaults are reported to the police. And so it's always in the back of my head of like, why not? What could we be doing differently? And maybe that, you know, the police are not the people, right, that we would want to be reporting this to, right? And just like a lot of these calls, I was reading incident reports when I, before I started with you, and like the number of people who call about custody disputes and like low level things, right? Where I'm sure they're, it's very disconcerting and traumatic for the people involved. And I don't want to take away from that, but it's not necessarily a police matter. And how terrible it must be for the kids, right? To have your parents fighting so much, you know, arguing about who's going to have, you know, you for the weekend, that the police need to be involved. And I think that maybe there's other ways that we could be addressing some of these problems.
Yeah, absolutely. I use this anecdote a lot that in my apartment building, one day, the long story short is that there's a dog that has bit another dog. And their owners can't separate them. But the only thing to do is to like call the police, which not that that's not the right decision, but it's that element of like, we're asking police officers to respond from everything from cats in trees to possible homicides. You know, it's just that.
And what's the expectation? Yeah. What's the expectation of what the police will do in that incident?
Exactly. Absolutely. Like, what are we asking them to do in that moment when they're coming up and being like, there's a dog that bit another dog. What do I, like, right? I mean, they're not necessarily, is there, if someone were asking me to have the expertise to cover as wide of a range of situations as they are, like, I just, to an extent, can't fathom it. So when you were speaking, one of the things that I wanted to sort of ask a little bit more about is, can you speak more to what you mentioned about wanting to look at the response to behavioral health? Can you explain a little bit more just for folks who might not fully understand?
Sure. So right now I am the academic partner for the Boston Police Department and I look at their co-response program. I evaluate it. And the co-response program involves having a licensed clinician. So in this case, social workers who ride along with police officers and they go to calls that involve people with mental illnesses. And lots of other things too, but they're supposed to be there to de-escalate those calls, to maybe connect the person to other services within the city and make sure that there's not a formal police response if it's not warranted, right? And so that is a lot of the work that I do right now, It kind of stems from that. I started off looking at crisis intervention teams in Chicago with Amy Watson, who's also a social worker. It was sort of my, showed me the path of like being able to do both the criminal justice and the social work at the same time. And so there's lots of these ways of responding. And it's, there's not a lot of evidence about how much they work. We know for crisis intervention teams that they reduced stigma among police officers about people with mental illnesses, but most of these initiatives really focus on the acute encounter, right? And that's sort of been my, like, is there force used, right? People are alive, people are not arrested. These are great things, right? But it's mostly a Band-Aid then, because that person still doesn't have access to medication. That person still doesn't have a stable place to live. That person is still using, you know, drugs to mask, right? Or control their whatever their symptoms are. And so it's only a matter of time before the police are going to be back again, right? And so, part of my interest is what's the long term here? Like, what does this mean long term? We know, like, so some of these initiatives work really well in the short term, it looks like, right? That they're able to make sure that there's not an arrest, that people are sent on their way if they don't want treatment. But what does this mean long term? And that's sort of my interest in the behavioral health. But I mean, in the past year, I've been thinking a lot about how if you call your therapist or you call a social worker and it's after hours, they'll say, if this is an emergency, call 911, right? And so, I think a lot about how the mental health profession, right, how they're sort of complicit in whatever the outcome is with when the police respond to these calls, right? If you're 2 a.m. and you're having a police officer come who's, you know, had the opportunity to receive mental health training and see somebody holding a knife or whatnot, right? I mean, that's, you know, their therapist sent them.
Absolutely. Yeah. I have, you know, friends who are clinicians who have acknowledged the same thing of like, when I'm not available, like my outgoing message is to call 911. Like, how is that actually helping anything? But them feeling like they're legally responsible to do that, one, and also that they don't want clients to be in crisis and unable to access someone. But that, yeah, our default has become that's how you respond, is by reaching out to the police.
So I do wonder about like if there was another option, right? If there was that, like, what would it be? What would it look like? And how would we determine if it was like safe, you know, because you don't want to send a clinician in to go talk to somebody who is violent, right? I mean, that's not the answer either. But how do then we separate out those calls where it's somebody who's really in crisis and in trouble and needs to talk to another human, right? Or maybe needs to be somewhere for their protection versus somebody who may cause harm.
Yeah, it's certainly not an uncomplicated question, right?
Absolutely. And let's be honest, I mean, social work folks are not paid a lot, right? I mean, it's not a 24-hour job. We can't make it that way either.
Yep.
Police are paid a lot, right? It is something to consider.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a very important point as well. Yeah. With that project of working with the Boston Police Department, do you have any sort of preliminary or initial thoughts or findings that you're seeing with doing the evaluation of this program?
So I've had a couple of papers come out from that project. I've been working with them, I think, since 2016. Yeah, it's been a while. What we found is the city council has decided that they like the program. It was all grant funded. Right. It was all funded through DOJ's, the Bureau of Justice Assistance, the Justice Mental Health collaboration grants. And so they've decided that they would like to continue it. So it's now part of the operating budget for the city of Boston, which is a huge deal because, you know, when things are grant funded, they go away. And then they stop and start. And it's also hard then for police officers to say, this is a program that I know is here, right? And so I know it's in for the long haul and I know this is a person that I can contact. So prior to this, before when we had inklings that this might happen, there was funding to look at a dedicated car. So what it was that clinicians were riding along with officers and they would primarily respond to calls for service involving mental health, but not always. So if there was, say, like a robbery in the area or something like that, then, something that was high priority, the clinician would wait in the car and the officer would then respond to the other call. And that time was used as like report writing. It wasn't like wasted time. But if there was a mental health call during that time, the clinician could not go by his or herself. They had to wait for an officer. And so we looked to see, we looked at a month of dedicated car time. So we had money in the budget for 2 weeks, and then the police department kicked in another 2 weeks. So a month, you know, I mean, we're looking at it, not the most rigorous evaluation, but, you know, it was a start, right? And we thought it could be descriptive and it would tell us something. And we did find that the clinician was really busy, that there was lots of time was spent on follow-up, which is sort of interesting for me to think about, like what the role, what a different role could be in the long term, is that when you're in that acute moment, people are in crisis, they may not be willing to accept help. And it's not because they don't want it, but it's because when you're in crisis, you're thinking like, I need to fix this immediate situation now. But maybe a week later, you know, or 2 weeks later, you're like, okay, you know, this is a situation I'd like to change. The other part of that too is, you know, that label of service resistant that I can't stand, right? That maybe the services you're offering are not the services that I need. And it's not that I'm service resistant, right? It's that this isn't a fit. And you can't always tell that when somebody's in crisis. You can't get that information out of them. Like, what do you need? Like, oh, is it that you don't want to go anywhere? You can't take your dog, right? Like, I get that, right? The dog's been with you on the street. Those sorts of things where later, a week later, when the situation's calmed down, right, then you can find out that information. And then maybe then you can propose services that may be more amenable to what that person actually needs to go forward. And so, you know, that proactive time, that being able to follow up and do that work, right, was actually, I think, how the clinician ended up spending most of her time and was really valuable. Was also interesting was after we collected data for a month after the pilot ended, was that more officers were contacting the clinician even the month after, because now they knew that she was there and they knew that she was helpful and that she could take calls off their hands, right? That they would come on people on the street and they would see that there was a problem. There was nothing criminal, you know, in that sort of gray area, right? That Amy Watson and Jen would describe of like where we could arrest this person, but to what end? And how is that in the interest of justice? We don't want to, but we know that this is a person who needs assistance or else we will be back seeing this person later. And so they were able to refer those encounters to her, to the clinician, and then she could go back and follow up with those people and their family. And I, again, can't tell you long-term what that meant for them, but to me, that seems promising, at least in the short term, as a place to put, right? It's another tool in the toolbox of like, what do we do to help these vulnerable people on the street?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I think, it's just such an important model to even at least be trying, right? Because it's a step in the right direction of saying, what could work here? What could be different? And are there other states or places where similar models are being tested and deployed?
No. Or? There is so much going on right now that I honestly, from day to day, can't even follow it all. I just read in Austin, Texas, now they are allowing callers to suggest what services they want to come for 911.
Oh,
do they want fire? Do they want police? Or do they want some kind of mental health responder? Yeah. So I'm a little curious about that because we know 911 data is kind of garbage because people either, you know, like they either try to underplay or overplay what's happening. They try to control the response. And I don't know if that will affect what's happening. You know, and a lot of the calls to 911 are not police call. You know, they're not emergency calls. So I'm curious to see how that works out. But there are programs all over on the West Coast. There's CAHOOTS also, which is a non-police team, right? That they respond to folks out in the community. I think it was San Francisco. I want to say somewhere else West Coast where they have community paramedics where they go and help people out on the street who are having medical issues. So I think, you know, the outreach is there for sure. It looks a little different in every community. Co-response looks different in the communities that do it as well. I think there's a conference this week in Kansas, actually, where a co-responder conference looking at, right, the different ways that it is adopted across police departments. Because remember, there's between 12 and 18,000 police departments in the United States. I can't tell you how many. And every time I walk into a new one, I act like, you know, I pretend that I know nothing because it could be, you know, my assumptions do not always help in terms of how things operate.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see the data and the changes that we see over the next year as new things have been rolled out and how they work, how they last, if they end up having staying power, I guess, you know.
I have real concerns. I have concerns about the funding levels for these things.
Absolutely.
Funding levels for evaluations, but also funding levels for programs. And I know a lot of communities are thinking about diverting calls to mental health providers from 911. And I think that there are a lot of calls that could be there. Like, person runs out of medication, they don't need a police officer coming to their house. They need someone to help them through the logistics of how to get more. But I worry that if these mental health agencies are not funded enough, like, what happens the first time that they can't reach somebody, right? Or like, there's nobody there to answer the phone, or they're overwhelmed by calls. And I have real concerns about, like, the first time something goes wrong, where it's like, oh, this didn't work, we should go back to the way it was. And then it'll be a long time before we can try something else again, because there'll be the distrust there.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Thinking about that, thinking about next steps and sort of what happened, the sort of last question I always ask everybody is, if I were to give you, or, you know, NIJ maybe, to give you an unrestricted, unlimited pot of money, for work, for research, what would you want to see done with it? What would you do?
Ooh, well, I have a proposal into NIJ right now, which it would be lovely if that was funded. I'm looking at co-response in schools, and whether or not it can help reduce, you know, or assist with mental health outcomes in schools and reduce
for sure
usage.
Yeah.
And so that would be awesome. I think I'm also really interested in these alternate responses, right? And like, what the long-term effects are. And I think that is where the money needs to go, until really like a rigorous study where we can say, you know, and not just whether, like, what it does in the acute incident, but what it does long-term. I think that there'll be more crime reporting, right? I think a lot of this 50% of people who is not reporting sexual assaults, I think a lot of that are vulnerable people, right? Who, this is a problem, but it's not really the biggest problem that they're facing at the moment once the incident's over. And so to commit themselves to 2 to 3 years of court proceedings, right? That's just not, it's not on their agenda, right? It's not something that feels manageable. So I think if we could measure that as well. But I think, you know, these alternate responses, be it in school or in the community, like, what is the long-term effect, right? After that acute incident is over, how does this affect the trajectory of people's lives?
Yeah, like, really stepping away from the band-aids of, like, we implemented this program as a response, but it might go away. It might, we don't know if it has an impact. Just all these things, right? That, like, help in this moment, or like, we want in this moment, but then not having that long-term. And I know the multi-site is the logistical nightmare, but right, the unrestricted pot of money.
Yes.
Unrestricted time, you know, in that the beautiful vision of, like, let's take multi-site with a strong research team and really do some longitudinal data collection on these different models and see, like you're saying, like, what actually happens, so that there's a way to say, okay, well, we've figured this out, like, or not, we haven't solved it, but, like, we got a strong case for this being usable. And so let's put it in other cities and see what happens, you know, and that feels like it could be really, really meaningful and really important to do. So,
absolutely.
Well, and I'm not stick ferns.
Well, I mean, I think it's safe to say that there's not going to be one tool that will solve the problem for everything and everybody, right? I mean, you know, and I'd like to say that there will never be a time when police are responding to no calls for service involving people with mental illnesses or other vulnerable folks. Like, that is just always going to be a reality, and they should be as well trained and well everything as possible, right? Prepared for these incidents. But at the same time, it is entirely possible to reduce the footprint. There are some calls that they are responding to that are completely unnecessary for them to respond to, not good for the community, and not a good use of police time either. And, you know, they are trained to respond to incidents in a certain way.
Yeah, right. I talk about this book way too much, but it's that upstream book of, like, systems create the exact outcomes that they're meant to, you know, like, we're surprised with the down the line impact when we've always kind of been like in that way. And I don't think that that means that every system has to be totally just thrown out the window. But I think it's the sort of a bit of naivete to look at the down the line and be like, oh, I can't believe this is happening. These terrible people are doing these things. It's like, well, these individuals exist in a system that has taught them that this is the only way that they know how to respond. And so we're shocked by an outcome that I'm not sure that we're really setting up for something different.
Oh, but I think it even goes further back than that. I mean, I think about like policing homelessness, for example. Sure. You set up laws that say that people can't loiter and they can't be here and they can't sleep out on the street and they can't do this. And then when you set those laws, who is set to enforce them? Right. I mean, I thought about this a lot with the mask laws too. Like when they're saying like people have to be masked in public or else there's a fine. Well, who is going to be enforcing that? Right. So if you're creating new work for the police without saying so, you then can't be angry at the police for not without guidelines, right? I mean, there were no guidelines for those laws either, really. It was like, basically, like if you're inside, you need to have a mask. Well, that's a new responsibility, right? And every time one of those laws is passed, it's potentially a new responsibility without a lot of logistical information on how it should be enforced. I think, you know, we need to take a step back and think about that as well. Like every time an ordinance is passed and what that means and how you would want the police to enforce it. And do you want them to enforce it? And if not, don't pass it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so thinking about from your experience, from your background, like about criminal justice, what would you want to see maybe be the field next bucket of work? I can assume that the answer might be the response teams and growing that, but like from what we've talked about, but yeah, like if you think about criminology or the criminal justice field in this violence prevention space, what do you want to see as kind of their next step?
That's a big question. I do wonder if we look at this alternate response, like what the ripples are for the rest of the criminal justice system. And I think, I hypothesize that this means that there's more effort for more serious offenses. And does this mean that there's more prosecution or does it stay the same? Right. I mean, I think I feel like the prosecutors are really sort of this unknown like portion of the violence prevention process. And we've focused so much on, I think, like jury education and police reform. And we miss this whole middle part where like they're making the decisions. There's a reason why prosecutors are considered to have the most discretion in the criminal justice system. And we know the least about them, I think. It's kind of getting myself out of a job here, but for future research, but I think I would like to see more focus on that and how that decision-making takes place and what the differences between people who are elected or appointed as DAs and, you know, these new progressive DAs, like what does this mean for violence, right? And for protecting people. We know that people who are offenders are also victims, right? And how is that being addressed at that stage of the criminal justice process?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Been really lovely to talk to you. And I just, good luck as you navigate next steps.
Thank you. It was nice to meet you as well.
Yeah, fingers crossed for that NIJ grant.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Coffee Chats with Researchers. You can always find more of these coffee chats on our website, which is vawconsortium.rutgers.edu. And of course, you can always reach out to us via social media or via email. We are always happy to hear from you with your thoughts, your questions, your feedback, or just generally to give us a hello. As always, stay curious, ask questions, drink coffee, and we will see you for our next episode of Coffee Chats with Researchers.